For the past several weeks, we've made the point that words have meaning. And the purpose of that meaning is to convey a thought. And so we all do well to take time to consider what we say and what we mean by what we say, and to try to speak as clearly as we can with that. However, we understand that there are times when we develop phrases and ideas that may be understood to a small group of people, but not maybe to a group at large. And so we've examined some of these. We started out by talking about the phrase, "that sounds denominational," and how really that is not a very good way of determining Bible accuracy. We looked at some things that we talk about in our worship, that we partake of the elements or we lay by in store. And while these are certainly important phrases, good phrases to more modern ears, they might not make a lot of sense. So we have to understand, A, what we mean by it, but B, then speak it in a way that could be understood by others. This morning, I had a hard time deciding what I wanted to call this lesson. It was a toss-up between "the invitation will now be extended" or "let us stand and sing." Both of them get us to the same place. And so as we think about this, if you're like me, you are really familiar with invitations. I have in times past tried to figure out how many invitations I've heard over the years. And it brings us to realize that something that has grown this common, probably we need to stop and make sure we understand exactly what it is that we're seeking to do. Now, many of the things I've talked about thus far, if they're not in the Bible, I said it's kind of hard to figure out where the phrase came from. It's not so much with this one. The history of this particular phrase is rather documented, and it extends in several directions. The earliest examples of this were not called the invitation, but actually it was known as the altar call. And this seems to have originated with Anglican churches that would have some kind of replica altar up in the pulpit area. And there would be people who maybe before their service began would come up to this area and they would pray. And there seems to be another phrase that kind of gets its same inspiration at that point, and that's the phrase, the anxious bench. And so if you can see the screen up there, you can see two illustrations of that. As time progressed on, I don't know if it was because people stopped being terribly comfortable with an altar at the front of the building, but it wasn't too terribly long before this was transformed into what was known as the invitation system. This developed during some of the big revivalist movements during our history as a nation. And so there would be revivalist preachers like Charles Finney who would go around and give very emotional, very evangelistic sermons, and at the end of them would extend the invitation to act on what had been said. Now, as we move a little bit closer to our times, there were evangelists who picked up on this idea, who became known for being somewhat of revival evangelist, who would go around the country and maybe have big meetings and perhaps go for weeks, names such as Billy Sunday or Billy Graham you might be familiar with. And they would oftentimes set up these big tents, and again, kind of like the earlier revivalist, would give very, very evangelistically oriented sermons. And there came to be somewhat of a slang for the invitation system. And some of you may be old enough to remember this, but in these big tents, you would have the aisle area, and oftentimes the aisle area would have sawdust on it so that if it got muddy, you wouldn't get it all over you. And so the phrase became hitting the sawdust trail. If you were going to respond to this sermon and devote your life to Christ, then you would hit the sawdust trail. What's really interesting is that a lot of independent churches started picking up this system and simply calling it the invitation. How it's differed in more primitivist churches, independent churches, is that the sermon does not necessarily have to be an evangelistic sermon for the invitation to be offered. And so you likely have heard, as I've said on many occasions, you've probably heard many times, where a preacher will give his sermon and say, now this sermon was not to convince you to become a Christian, but, and transition then into this time, if there's any who would like to become a Christian, now's the opportunity. I once worked with an elder who was very much a proponent of that. In fact, I heard him say that there must never be an assembly without an invitation. And while that sounds very nice on the surface, it put me in an awkward situation or two, where even at this particular church, there would be summer classes for kids, but yet I was expected to give an invitation to those kids. So, here we are. And we can see that this has been kind of a compilation of history that's come about. Tradition that maybe has been tradition so long that there are those who do believe that we are in the wrong if an invitation is not offered with every sermon. And so this morning, what I want us to do is just to explore the invitation. What is it all about? What do we mean by it? What's the purpose behind it? To understand that if we are going to have this, we need to make sure that it is accomplishing its purpose. So let's begin where we need to, by asking, whose invitation is this anyway? That if we're talking about an invitation or the invitation, who exactly is inviting whom? And of course, we understand that if this is done in the right way, the Lord's invitation is what must be fully under consideration. There are several places in the New Testament where Jesus Himself extends His invitation. We think about in Matthew chapter 11, where He says, "Come to Me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take My yoke upon you and learn from Me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for My yoke is easy and My burden is light." This gives us a very good illustration of what the Lord's invitation is. First of all, it is not begging someone to come. The Lord is not in some negotiating frame of mind where He's begging. He's saying the invitation is for everyone to come to Me. He's going to repeat that as He gives this great call about those who thirst, even as we've just sung about. It says, the last day of the great feast, the great day, Jesus stood up and cried out, "If anyone thirst, let him come to Me and drink." The Lord's invitation is always the invitation to come. And then it's illustrated in parable form. One other example we'll look at is where He says, and at that time of the banquet, He sent His servant to say to those who had been invited, "Come," here's our idea, "come to Me, for everything is now ready." Jesus' invitation, it may sound simple to say, but extremely important, must always be Jesus' invitation and no one else's. How did Jesus offer that invitation? Many ways. In fact, as He was talking to His apostles, He encouraged them of better things to come. "You know that in My Father's house are many rooms, and I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go, I'll return again to take you where I am." The idea that there is something bigger and better waiting beyond the life that we know now. And so His invitation oftentimes would encourage people to think of that kind of thing, of what's going to come when God and man are united together eternally with nothing separating, where sin has ceased to exist and we are at home with Him. Yet, on the other hand, Jesus sometimes would give it in a very negative sense. We think about Mark chapter 9, where Jesus says, you know, it'd be a whole lot better just to pluck your eye out and cut off your hand than to end up in the place where God is not. And so there was times where God would use very, very strong language as He would give this invitation to think about what's being given up. So sometimes it's emphasizing the positive. Sometimes it's emphasizing what you want to stay away from. Sometimes it was given very gently. I love the story of the woman at the well, because here is a woman who had lived a very sinful life.
And yet Jesus did not turn his back on her. He didn't shun her as many others had, but yet he very gently led her along to an understanding of who he is. And I love the way that story ends, because not only does she become a follower of Jesus, she goes back to the village and she brings all these other people and they say, look, you came and got us, but we are followers because of what he said. That gentleness drew people to him. And yet we also find that at times he would word it very strongly as he was talking to the Pharisees, using language that's somewhat troubling to us, where he calls them hypocrites and stiff-necked people and talks about all of the things that they did that were causing trouble. Yet we're seeing this invitation offered in one consistent way, no matter the way that he offered it. It was always bringing someone to understand that Jesus Christ is the only way to salvation. There is no other way. There is nobody else. And Jesus quite firmly would make that point with every invitation that he offered. So then, what you and I must understand is that if an invitation, if the invitation is being given, any call that de-emphasizes Jesus Christ is a false call. Any invitation that is trying to encourage someone to do anything else but completely devote his or her life to Jesus Christ is not the Lord's invitation. So then, we have to make sure that we don't fall into things like telling people, you need to come back to the church. That is a phrase I am so happy to say is on its way out. I don't hear it, but I remember as a kid hearing that quite a bit, that you would talk about someone coming back to the church or seeking the church's forgiveness. And while there may be some truth in those statements, certainly if I have offended a congregation or I've been a member who's brought shame, I might need to apologize. But the invitation for forgiveness that we talk about in the sense of Jesus Christ is not delivered by a group of people. It is forgiveness that is offered only through Him, that Jesus is the one who's going to forgive. Now, I need to put a little bit of a note with the next one, that this is not some kind of cathartic exercise to unburden. Let me explain what I mean by that. Sometimes we are told in the psychology world, and I agree with this, by the way, that the best way to get over something is to own it. If you've done something wrong, admit you've done it, go to somebody, make amends for it, that's a good way of kind of getting your life back to where it needs to be. However, when we talk about the Lord's invitation, though that may be a very nice side benefit of it, its purpose is not simply to unburden, to make myself feel better. The invitation is to get myself back right with the Lord, to restore that relationship that I've broken because of sin. And I may come and I may ask a group to pray with me. It's not that they have the ability to forgive. But yet it's the idea that we're all coming together, and I realize the power that's found in prayer, and I'm asking others to join me as I approach God with it. What I'm seeking to do always, if indeed this is what I'm seeking to do in answering the Lord's invitation, is to restore that relationship with Him. So then, it is a call, when the Lord's invitation is given, for full commitment to Jesus Christ and nothing else. It is the call to say, I am going to die to sin and I am going to alter from here on out to whom I give my allegiance, to whom I give my obedience, to whom I seek to please in everything I do. Jesus Christ is supreme. Now, that is a very deep thought. That is a very challenging idea to say everything about my life is about to do a complete change even in the things that I'm doing well, now I'm going to do them not for any honor I'm getting, but to allow God to be seen in me. That's what's happening with the Lord's invitation. So, what that then means is that there is a combination of things taking place. There is a combination of reaching the intellect, a combination of using emotion, and a combination even of using fear. And so as we think about offering the Lord's invitation, we've got to make sure that these latter two are not emphasized to the exclusion of the first. I'll explain what I mean by that. There are many, many times that the invitation has been offered, at least in my hearing and probably some that I've done, that have relied very heavily on emotion. Let me say, there is nothing wrong with that. The danger is if it's totally emotion-based. Some of you are going to have no idea of the illustration that I'm about to offer, but if you're older, you will. You may remember that back when you only had 3 or 4 channels on your television, that once a year, all your favorite programs went off for 24 hours, and a network would have a telethon. You remember those? You'd have one of the most famous, the Jerry Lewis telethon. And so you would have all of these celebrities that would come on, and in the background, there are all these folks with telephones, and the phones are ringing and they're writing. And what was going on is there were people pledging, saying, I'll give this amount of money. And oftentimes, when they would bring on a child who was suffering with the disability or a person who had this disability for whom the telethon was designed to help, the phones would immediately take off. Every phone's being picked up and answered. You ever read the details of that? Only a fraction of the people who called in to those programs ever sent in their money. I suspect one of the main reasons for that is when you see a child who has this problem, this sickness, or an adult who's really overcome, there's a certain amount of emotion that hits you. And in that moment, you say, I want to give $100, I want to give $200, $500. But then when that excitement, that emotion kind of calms down, there's second thoughts. And that's the real danger when an invitation is offered strictly on emotion. Because it ends up producing very short-term results. There may be a lot of excitement, a lot of enthusiasm. But yeah, listen to what the Lord says about this. When He says, as for what was sown on rocky ground, this parable that He gave, this is the one who hears the word and immediately receives it with joy. Yet he has no root in himself, but he endures for a while. And when tribulation or persecution arises on account of the word, immediately he falls away. That was someone who was emotion-based. The joy was there, the excitement was there, the enthusiasm, and probably for a week or two or three or a month or two or three, there's a lot of excitement and just almost you can't stop this guy or this girl. But then that emotion fades. And so does the commitment, because the commitment was never there to begin with. Emotion's important. But yet, if it is emotion alone, that is not going to produce the result that God desires from us. The same thing can be said about fear. Fear is extremely important. The Lord Himself, as we've already mentioned, would at times employ the idea of fear to say, this is what's going to happen if you do not come to me, if you ignore what I want you to do. But we have to realize that though Jesus did use it, though we'll see it in other places, there's got to be the rest of the story. Let's look at an example of this. I want you to think about what Peter says. As he says in 2 Peter chapter 3, but the day of the Lord will come like a thief, And then the heavens will pass away with a roar, and the heavenly bodies will be burned up and dissolved, and the earth and the works that are done on it will be exposed. Since all these things are thus to be dissolved, what sort of people ought you to be in your lives of holiness and godliness? Now, that's employing a fair amount of fear. When you think about a time when you're going to have a fire burning and God's coming without warning and there's going to be consequences and everything's going to be laid out in the open, that's a fairly fearful thing. Do I need to understand that? I sure do. That there will come a time when everything I've said, everything I've done, everything I've taught, God and I are going to have a discussion about that. Fear needs to motivate. But not fear alone. And Peter himself illustrates that. Because as we continue on, he's going to show that if you only have fear, you are missing the grand point of salvation. Listen to how he finishes this passage. Waiting for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be set on fire and dissolved, and the heavenly bodies will melt as they burn. But according to his promise, we are waiting for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. You see, if the only reason I become a Christian is because I'm terrified of God, I'm never going to long for that day when I'll be with Him. God says, you need to understand the consequences of not turning. You need to understand the danger of refusing my invitation. However, I want that to very much be eclipsed by the fact that you are understanding what it means to be with me eternally. So then, any invitation can employ emotion and it can employ fear, but what it had better do is to engage the intellect. Because as we have already noted, what God is calling on me to do is extremely serious. God is calling on me to change everything. And I must understand what that looks like. The Apostle Paul put it this way, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave Himself for me. That's commitment. That's change. And that's what the Lord's invitation calls on us to do. And anything that encourages a shallowness to do it for any other reason is going to be detrimental in the long run. So with all that said, what's the implication here? Practically speaking, what does that mean for us? What it means is that every time someone extends the invitation, one is speaking for God. And that's serious business. Peter said it like this, whoever speaks as one who speaks oracles of God. If I'm standing up or even in a discussion with someone on my own and I say, this is the Lord's invitation, I better make sure. I better make sure that those are the words that He has authorized me to say, because what I'm saying is, I speak for Him. So then, when this is done publicly, it is not a training session. It's not kind of like the junior leagues for a sermon. That is not what this is all about. Anytime I am taking the serious responsibility for telling someone this is what salvation is all about, I better make sure I know what I'm talking about. So then, I take this very seriously. And the response to that invitation must never be based on a speaker. I remember having a discussion with a sweet little lady. She was a good friend of mine. And there was a young man in the congregation had given an invitation. And she was just glowing about him. But I remember what she said. She said, he just gave this great invitation. And somebody came to him that night. And that is exactly what someone who delivers the Lord's invitation does not want. The encouragement is focus on Jesus Christ. It shouldn't matter who gives the invitation. Shouldn't matter who it is who's bringing the message. The message is coming from Jesus Himself. And the response must always be between the individual and his or her Savior. As well, we need to understand that the invitation is simple. We've read it three times over, but yet it rests on extremely complex ideas. And those being that we must understand what God has done to bring all of this together. I'm not saying that to become a Christian, you've got to have the Bible completely down. I hope not, or all of us are in trouble, right? I'm not even saying that we've got to have all of these things accomplished to a mastery level. We think about in the book of Acts, every one of those conversions took place after somebody gave the invitation of Jesus Christ, but it was always with an explanation of who God is and what God has done and what Jesus Christ has done and the response for which that calls. Someone who becomes a Christian must understand what grace means. Must understand what real mercy is all about. Must understand what sin is and what sin causes. And how that the grace and the mercy and the love of God are much more powerful than that. And how all of this comes together when I call on His name in faith, being buried in baptism for the forgiveness of my sins. I must be very cautious that all the pieces of the puzzle are there. I must understand that as extremely important as baptism is, it is not more important than the rest of the salvation story. And to understand baptism without understanding God's grace and mercy is not going to give me that complete picture that I need. Thus, we have to understand that an invitation can never, unless it's going to be a full-length sermon, and even then a long one, going to express all of those ideas that someone needs to hear in order to make that decision about becoming a Christian. The invitation also does not rely on new insights. That's not the point of it. And so a man who is delivering the Lord's invitation must never feel that he's got to say something brand new. I say that because I am that guy. It's like, how can I say this differently? How can I get the words together? How can I do this or that to deliver something of this nature? In fact, that's a very dangerous thing. Let me share with you when I learned that for sure. My work with young people, it's always a challenge to get and keep their attention. And just by the age, we all understand that. And I remember delivering, this many years ago, remember delivering a talk and the kids were engaged and I had come up with this story to really grab their attention and they were with me and I gave it and I sat down, thought, well, I've accomplished my purpose. Another man came up, not insultingly at all, you know, not kind of sarcastically making a point. He came up and said, Mr. Chandler, that was one of the funniest talks I've ever heard. That was a life-altering moment for me. Because I said, I failed. Absolutely, 100% failed when my example outshone the point I was wanting to make. And I keep that in the front of my mind, and when I give an example in a sermon, and someone comes out the back door, and the very first thing they want to talk about is that example, I'm usually done with it. I won't use it again. Because it eclipsed the point. Everything's to draw to Jesus Christ, not to replace Him. And I must understand that if I am going to go about the serious business of talking for God, I can use a story. The Lord certainly did. I can use examples. The apostles certainly did. But I must never, ever allow those things to hide the message that must shine in what I'm seeking to say. Let me just end in this way by saying that the invitation system is a tradition. It is a tradition. It's not a bad tradition. Traditions can be good, and this one certainly can be good. But we are not going to find anywhere in the Bible where an apostle or a preacher ends his sermon, extends the invitation, and says, "Come while we stand and sing together." Never going to find that. Now, that being said, that doesn't mean it's wrong. And it doesn't mean it's a wrong system, but it is something we must understand is a way that we have put into place to try to encourage people to become Christians. And anytime we do that, we need to make sure that what we're doing is giving the very best opportunity possible. And so there may be times and occasions where a church is going to say, "Well, this is just not the way." Or, "This is just not an appropriate time." And almost always the counter to that is, "But somebody might be there who wants to become a Christian." I'm going to encourage us that we have the kind of relationship with those who are not Christians where it doesn't have to be a public call from this pulpit, but yet the closeness where someone can call you or can call me and say, "I'm ready to become a Christian," and we can take care of that. We simply have to make sure that what we're doing is the very best way. Now, with all that said, what is the best response that an invitation has ever gotten? Can I show you a contender? When they heard this, they were cut to the heart and said to Peter and the rest of the apostles, "Brothers, what shall we do?" That's the best response. When someone hears the word, the emotion was in Peter's sermon, the fear was in Peter's sermon, but the intellect is what shines out. And all of that came together. And these people did not have to be approached. They could do nothing else but say, "What do we need to do?" That's the best response, isn't it? And thus, whenever I give a full-length sermon or a short talk, I need to understand that's still the best response. The invitation, as we think about it, is not one to teach salvation. It is an encouragement for those who already know the plan of salvation. And there's a place for that. But what we must understand is that if we are teaching the full thing, or whether we're only providing a glimpse to encourage someone who already knows that they need to act, let's make sure that Jesus Christ is always, always the essential part of what we say. You know, when you give a sermon like that, the big question that comes to your mind is, well, do you offer an invitation now? The answer to that is yes. Not to teach the full picture of salvation, though we've discussed a lot of it, but simply to provide a time. And what we've done over the years to make this a little less awkward is to sing a song that we oftentimes call the song of encouragement or the invitation song. That's going to echo some of those ideas that are present to hopefully convince the intellect of someone who's been holding out, that it's time to stop, that Jesus is ready to save. And we do that this morning. If you know the Lord's plan of salvation, don't delay. But let me remind you, you don't have to come to the front of the building. If you're ready to become a Christian and you don't want all these eyes staring at you, we'll clear everybody out, and you and I can take care of it, because it's God who saves. If you need to answer that call this morning, you can come now while we sing together.